Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's trying really hard not to get gaslighted. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and present but not involved is my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
At the start of this year, we picked who we thought would be the movers and shakers in British politics over the following 12 months. We're going to see in this episode how bad our predictions have been. So we checked in last in Easter, about a third of the way through the year, to see how our predictions are doing. And now we're checking in two-thirds of the way of the year before Parliament returns from recess. If you remember, we picked a politician from various different strata of British politics, and now, in our perfectly subjective way, we're going to try and work out who's had more influence in British politics over the last 8 or 9 months or so. And the winner, I believe, gets bragging rights.
And maybe buys you the one who drink at Christmas.
Quite possibly. So let's start with party leaders that we picked then.
Yep.
And I picked Theresa May, and you picked Jeremy Corbyn. This one has kind of seesawed throughout the year, hasn't it? Mine looked a really terrible pick back in January because we had the botched reshuffle. It then looked slightly better round about April, May time, about with a Skripal poisoning, Corbyn's reaction to that, which was seen as being suboptimal in a lot of ways. Then my pick of May looked even worse as she seemed to gradually lose the authority around her cabinet. Now, but we're recording this at a time when it's probably the lowest point in terms of the Jeremy Corbyn story arc we've been at a while, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we've basically gone from Jeremy Corbyn's failures to deal with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, straight into Jeremy Corbyn laying a wreath, seemingly, to honour terrorists.
Now, I'm not going to engage with the wreath story or even comment on that because I value my notifications. But, yeah, the story's not brilliant. The press reaction to it from Corbyn himself hasn't been great. The reaction from Corbyn's surrogates on social media hasn't been great. We're going to get to that later, aren't we, Owen Jones? On the flip side for Corbyn, he's probably still quite in charge of the party. There's, I don't think, any credible attempt to oust him. Whereas, actually, with May, there is. Or it feels like there's something brewing. I almost wouldn't be surprised if 2 months later we could have this conversation and it would feel completely reversed again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing about both of their leaderships. It's that they're so swingy. You go from everything's fine to, oh my God, it's DEFCON 4. So at the moment, you know, I'd say you probably would give it to May. Her position, whilst it's technically not probably stronger than Corbyn's, she's at least currently less disaster and gaffe prone. Theresa May hasn't been the story since the Chequers deal was made, which is, you know, a decent amount of time given that before that point it was, can she do this? Is she able to survive? Since then it's just been Corbyn and Boris, both of whom having negative stories about them, who works in her favour. So I'd say it's May.
Right, that's one to me. Of course, if either of us had picked Don't Know at the start of the year, we'd be laughing.
I know. Unfortunately, we didn't include that as an option.
Yeah, that's my hot pick for 2019, I think. Cabinet minister we picked then. I picked the Govester, the one and only Michael Gove. You picked Jeremy Hunt.
Yeah, so my logic behind picking Jeremy Hunt back at the start of the year was that he was a potential, I don't know if rising star is quite the right term, but somebody whose lot was on the up in the Conservative Party. And I feel I've been justified in that. This is a man who was Health Secretary and has now been promoted to one of the four great offices of state, Foreign Secretary. That, to me, is a it's a pretty significant promotion and increases his influence over British politics, not just on the foreign affairs, but also on the domestic field as well, as he's clearly one of Theresa May's closest allies.
Well, indeed, even if he cannot remember the nationality of his wife. But I did feel a bit sorry for him because that was genuinely a slip of the tongue,
yeah,
and happens. But
It was hilarious.
Yes. My logic for picking Gove was that I thought he'd be quite an influential voice round the cabinet table in terms of maybe domestic policy, but particularly Brexit. In terms of domestic policy, he's one of the few ministers who can actually get things done at the moment. Actually, you probably count Hunt as part of that. Mm-hmm. And you probably add Sajid Javid to the mix, who would have been an interesting pick back at the start of 2018. But Gove stuff on the environment, like banning plastic straws, all that kind of stuff, is getting a little bit of traction. The fact that Gove was so much an outspoken supporter of the Chequers deal, which then got welched on by not only David Davis, but then Boris, and then even May herself kind of went back on it in the various parliamentary votes, suggests that maybe I overestimated Gove's influence among a lot of the Brexiters. I feel like he's a little bit too pragmatic for them.
I think that probably is the case. Gove has, as you say, been one of the few kind of members of the cabinet actually really doing anything. And as such, that does automatically put him quite high up in terms of the rankings for what we're talking about in terms of influence in British politics. But it does appear that his star is fading actually within the ranks of the Conservative Party itself. Maybe that is down to just the pragmatism on his part. Maybe it's because he was never actually as diehard as he made out. To begin with, either way, he does not appear to be taking the Brexiteers with him, with his stances on Europe.
We're going Mark to you, I suppose, for that one, for Jeremy Hunt.
I think so.
Then Shadow Cabinet Minister, I picked Angela Rayner, Shadow Education Secretary. You picked Shadow Foreign Secretary Emily Thornberry. It's a bit of a score draw, this one, I think. Both of them high-profile Shadow Cabinet members. Both of them at the start of the year were seen as very likely potential runners in the next Labour leadership contest whenever that happens. Both of them have probably consolidated that position essentially by saying very little critical of Corbyn in the various things that have come up. Angela Rayner tweeted that part of the We Are Corbyn hashtags, because the way to deal with a massive political crisis essentially is to just start a lot of hashtags, and that now solves a lot of problems.
Obviously, yeah.
Mm. If you are a regular listener, you'll know that one of Steve's pet hates is Labour's National Education Service, which is at the moment a slogan, not a policy. But I'm pleased to say that following consultation, they will be a policy announced in August. There'll be a policy announced conference time, which is very exciting, isn't it?
Watch this space for my inevitable rant about this policy in some form. I feel like it's going to be an absolute damp squib.
Emily Thornberry, I don't think, has said very much recently, and
not really done anything.
I
don't think either of them have particularly done anything. I think it's a draw.
I suppose the thing is that actually, like, in hindsight, maybe picking someone like Keir Starmer would have been a better bet.
And you did err on doing that, didn't you? You were going to go for...
I did, but he's, A, really, really boring. And B, it just seemed to make sense to go with a rising star. And C, I kind of wanted to keep the gender balance of my picks. But, I mean, in terms of shadow cabinet ministers that get any coverage, I think it was a red box survey for the Times political email.
McDonnell, wasn't it?
So, in terms of shadow cabinet ministers that get a lot of press coverage, John McDonnell, John Ashworth, who's Shadow Health, Keir Starmer, and Corbyn himself, I believe, are the ones who really, really monopolise press coverage. And there's a lot of shadow cabinet members who aren't really getting a lot of coverage, and if we're honest, probably aren't really pulling their weight. I mean, Corbyn has justifiably and understandably kept faith with those people who stepped up and filled the void when there was a massive resignation 2 years ago. But I think the fact you have got a lot of calibre on the back benches is starting to show a bit, I think, in the shadow cabinet. But, I mean, our picks, good, but there's not really much between them at the moment.
Yeah, at the moment, neither of them have done anything particularly to shine through.
I think we call that a draw.
I'd say you're right as well.
And at least neither of us picked Barry Gardiner.
Oh, thank Christ for that.
So moving on, then it was our backbencher. And again, we both picked very similar types of politicians in that we both picked female Remainer Tory, female Remainer Tories. I picked Sarah Wollaston and you picked Nicky Morgan.
Yeah, Nicky Morgan, obviously the chair of the Treasury Select Committee. My logic was that she'd be able to basically hold the government's feet to the fire in some form and would be basically a thorn in their side and therefore quite influential.
A thornberry in her side, you might say.
One might say that, yes.
Mm. Well, and I picked Sarah Wollaston partly because of the Remain the Rebel bit, as we said, but also because as an ex-GP, she's quite involved with health, I believe she's chair of the Health Select Committee, and health, especially social care, been quite a big issue over the last 60 years. And she has been working this year with Norman Lamb, Liz Kendall, and trying to put a cross-party commission together on social care. Mm-hmm. So there's been a little bit of movement in that direction. She's also, Sarah Wollaston, the first major Tory to come out in favour of a people's boat. A people's boat? No, that's Boaty McBoatface, isn't it? A people's vote on the Brexit deal, which maybe makes her a little bit of a mover, a shaker, a person.
Yeah, I'd say you're probably actually right there in that Wollaston probably does edge Morgan out at this point in time. If for no other reason than I suspect, if you were to kind of look at this, look at what they've both done from the perspective of a historian, you'd probably see more of Sarah Wollaston doing things which had the potential to be have more impact over the long term. Working with Liz Kendall, working with Norman Lamb to try and focus on specific campaigns, on specific policy agendas, is the sort of thing which, you know, has a lot more potential impact than just chairing the Treasury Select Committee, as important a job as that is, which is what Nicky Morgan's doing. Morgan hasn't had any particular major moments that I'm aware of as chair of the Select Committee, which would justify her as my pick. So I'd say at the moment, you're probably giving it to Wollaston just because she's doing more with less of a profile or less of a position.
Mm. So Wollaston just about edges it. I do wonder, though, with hindsight, whether it might have been better for us to pick a Leaver backbencher, maybe even a Labour backbencher. But I think like the spectre of Jacob Rees-Mogg probably hovered over our picks. We've said a couple of weeks ago, I think you said that we're past peak Mogg now. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's right. But I think my logic for going for a Sarah Wollaston rather than a Tory Leaver was because it felt like the Remainer rebels and the Tory benches were getting their act together. They started to win a couple of votes. Actually, what seems to have happened is that Dominic Grieve, who's the kind of ringleader of the rebels,
lost his nerve.
Kind of, yeah, the Grand Old Duke of York who marched them up to the hill and down again.
Yep.
Hindsight is a wonderful thing. That's the backbenchers. Their next pick was the non-English politician. I picked Ruth Davidson, leader of the Scottish Tories. You picked Arlene Foster, who's the leader of the DUP. I'm guessing, again, we picked them for fairly similar reasons. Both of them maybe hoping to be the tail that wags the Tory dog in two very different directions, actually. A kind of liberal Scottish and
conservative Irish.
Yeah, it's a very confused dog, this one. Again, this feels a little bit like a bit of a draw at the moment. I mean, Ruth Davidson's had a moment. She's talking nice liberal Tory things. So she was outspoken about Amazon tax evasion recently. She called for Boris to apologise for his remarks about the burqa. There's a minor scandal brewing, apparently, about what is called the dark money. I think the 320 grand that the Scottish Unionist Association Trust maybe gave to the Scottish Conservatives. The Electoral Commission are looking into them at the moment to see if they are a credible donor to a political party. So there is a potential bit of a trouble. If we come back at the end of the year, it's going to be interesting to see how Ruth Davidson fares on that score. Again, Arlene Foster's not... There's power sharing in Northern Ireland still isn't a thing.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, my choice of Arlene Foster was based on the notion that there would be a lot more, as you say, tail wagging the dog. And that hasn't happened. Now, I don't know, maybe it's the fact that the DUP is afraid of what might happen if they push things too far and then maybe they get another election. and that runs the risk of Corbyn getting in or whatever. But for some reason, other than the initial bung of, what was it, a billion?
I should know because we repeated it quite a lot on the airwaves. I think it was about a billion.
Yeah, about a billion of funding for Northern Ireland. There's not been much, if anything, heard from them. In fact, the only real news story that's kind of come out recently from the DUP is that Ian Paisley Jr. has been suspended because of dodgy dealings.
I don't think he disclosed financial things for a trip to Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
The Ian Paisley thing is a genuine schadenfreudegasm we should do a podcast on.
Yeah. Neither of them have particularly done that much, I'd say.
I suppose Ruth Davidson spoke at a think tank with Michael Gove, and Michael Gove compared them to Sonny and Cher.
Which is interesting, but what we haven't seen from Davidson is... What was talked about at one point with Davidson was the idea that she was going to lead the Scottish Tories that were in Parliament as a kind of a buffer to the Brexiteers or to the more out and out conservative Tories, because ultimately the idea was that, you know, Paul Masterson and the other Scottish Tories owed their jobs not to Theresa May but to Ruth Davidson,
which is probably true.
But that hasn't happened either. There's been no, you know, Scottish resistance that's developed. Whilst some of them have been rebels to a degree on some of the EU stuff, not especially compared to everybody else. So I'm not necessarily sure she has been using her influence to the full extent that she could. Therefore, her impact has been somewhat limited.
I suppose it's hard to gauge the impact on the Tory party, both the DUP and the Scottish Tories, essentially because the government just isn't passing any legislation at the moment. Mm-hmm. The only legislation it bothers passing is Brexit legislation, which it tries to ramrod through in about half an hour. So, I mean, especially even with the influence of the DUP, it's really hard to tell. I suppose you could argue, potentially, the fact that Arlene Foster rules out separate customs arrangements for Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK is maybe a sign that the influence of the DUP hangs over the Conservative Party and then the Brexit negotiations, because any agreement has to go through them. That's the sort of Damocles that Arlene Foster's got that Ruth Davidson maybe just doesn't have.
Yeah, quite possible.
Maybe Arlene Foster just about...
Just because of Brexit.
But we're talking
millimetres kinda, between them.
Yeah.
I'd say it probably is just about Arlene Foster.
Yeah.
So that's another one for me.
Just about, I think. Yeah. Then we had a politician not from either of the big two parties. My pick was Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the Scottish National Party, First Minister of Scotland. Your pick, bit of a wild card, Leila Moran, the Lib Dem MP.
Leila Moran, MP Foxes West and Abingdon, not a very well-known figure outside of the Liberal Democrats. Chose her because there was a very real chance that she would end up being a influential figure in the Lib Dems themselves, and potentially being putting herself in a position where she would be talked about as a potential future leader, which... Whilst there's not been a lot of necessarily media coverage about her or what she's been doing and all of that sort of stuff, she has been talked up as a future leader of the Lib Dems, to the extent where there were rumours doing the rounds, which were reported in various of the papers, that a coup was underway and that Vince Cable was going to be removed and that the beneficiary of said coup was going to be Leila Moran, with the idea being that she's young, photogenic, quite a good public speaker, and would be able to revitalise the fortunes of the Lib Dems in a way that musty old Vince Cable never would be able to.
None of his iterations of Vince Cable.
None of the many faces of Vince Cable are able to resolve the Lib Dems' problems.
No, but she's not got a big name recognition outside the Lib Dems, and I'm struggling to think of any kind of impact she's had other than not being Vince Cable, which, though laudable and accurate, I feel like you kind of need more than that.
Yeah, and I think that would be...
I mean, Tim Farron obviously didn't, but...
Yeah, I think that is a fair assessment. To be honest, I was expecting maybe a little bit more out of her on education and things like that, just maybe being a bit more of a a talking head, I suppose, in those sorts of subjects, in the way that Norman Lamb is.
Mm.
Which I'm not necessarily sure has happened. Maybe it's because she's still a relatively new MP,
mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, and she's trying to find her feet. She's in a marginal. She's focusing probably more on just making sure that she can maintain her seat.
And I suppose she's got the problem that any Lib Dem MP has at the moment, or any Lib Dem has at the moment, which is just trying to get a voice and trying to be out there, mm-hmm. because with the media climate they're in at the moment, with the number of MPs they've had, it's not like a Lib Dem is guaranteed to be on Question Time every week, BBC News every week, The Daily Politics every day. So it's just trying really hard to make yourself heard, I think.
It's not
just lay them around. I think it's a problem the party's got generally.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. But I know I felt that that Layla would have probably been a good fit for someone who might have been able to break out of that problem and actually get themselves some of that attention. And even in kind of Lib Dem friendly press, that doesn't seem to have been the case. So I'm happy to admit she's probably not done as well as I thought she might.
Maybe we should try and correct the bias of our podcast, because I have a feeling we're going to talk probably more about Layla Moran than we are about the First Minister of Scotland. Nicola Sturgeon, she's been First Minister, I think, about 4 or 5 years now. Mm-hmm. I think it's been quite a while. And recently, I think in June, her approval ratings, which have been basically a net zero in terms of approve or disapprove, dipped to about -2, which even after 4 or 5 years, it's not terrible.
Let's be honest, both Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn would kill for net -2 approval ratings.
I mean, I suppose the problem that the SNP have at the moment is I don't think Brexit has turned people yet against the union in the UK and pro Scottish independence. And maybe the SNP thought maybe it would. I mean, I say that we're 6 or 7 months away from potential Armageddon, so that's very, very subject to change. But I think it's quite hard for the SNP at the moment. There's not even, I don't know how effective they're governing at the moment, but I think there's going to be crunch Scottish elections up in the next year or two, which will be hard for them to. It's going to be hard to see how they'll make gains, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult for them to make gains, but at the same time, you know, they're only at the moment, it looks like they're only fighting on one front, which is against the Conservatives, given that Labour have not managed to regain much of their footholds in Scotland. So, all in all, I'd say Sturgeon has probably not had a bad year. You are right, they are playing a waiting game, but then playing a waiting game and nothing going majorly wrong, that is a victory in a way. So,
and she does run a country and Layla Moran doesn't.
Yes.
So if you're going to get Arlene Foster, I'm going to get Nicola Sturgeon.
I'm happy to admit that point.
Fantastic. Right, then we look to elected mayors. I picked Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London. You picked Andy Street, the West Midlands Metro Mayor, mm-hmm. and former chair of John Lewis, not to be confused with the Andy Street who was former chair of Oxford University Conservative Association.
Absolutely.
So it's a very different Andy Street. On this, okay, Sadiq Khan has been criticised for an ineffective response to the London knife crime and the crime wave there, but did make international news by approving a massive balloon of Donald Trump in a nappy and Twitter. Whereas Andy Street, who has been talked up in an article on Conservative Home as maybe part of some sort of dream leadership ticket in the future.
Andy Street, I find bizarre.
He, the desperate Steve, almost as desperate as, no, I'm not going there.
What we are.
Andy Street backed the Chequers deal, which is an interesting move politically for him, but also his main signature achievement as West Midlands Metro Mayor, apart from taking credit for all the stuff that Birmingham City Council's doing, he turned the trams blue. I'm going to say, last time we did this, it felt like Andy Street was beating Sadiq Khan. I would argue now it's the other way around.
I would say it's probably closer to a draw. The main point you seem to be raising in Khan's favour is that he said okay to not a particularly impressively sized balloon.
It was a massive balloon. It was the biggest balloon you've ever seen, Steve.
It was a tiny balloon.
Now, the hands were tiny. The balloon itself was big. That was the point. It was to Never mind.
But yeah, I mean, there's been bits and pieces that Andy Street has done, and even some of the various bits and pieces that have come out of Birmingham, such as the Clean Air Zone. This was actually something that Andy Street was talking up and providing actually some political cover for the Labour Council to do at the beginning of the year, where I believe it was literally I woke up on New Year's Day and Andy Street was on Radio 4 talking about a clean air zone in Birmingham as a potential way to deal with the health risks from diesel cars and things like that.
Shame he didn't tell that to the Birmingham Conservative Party, but maybe we'll save the parochial references for another podcast.
I mean, there's an entire thing to say about the Birmingham Conservative Party, but yeah, I mean, I think Street has been subtle in his influence. Bear in mind, we're still this year, he's still managed to successfully wrangle some new powers out of the government, which has not been necessarily been high profile and was very quickly moved out of the agenda, but it was done. So, like, don't forget that in your assessment, no. I would say.
No, that's true. And that did make international news, didn't it? Just like the balloon.
I think you'll find that its influence on British politics, not international politics, that we're measuring this on, Corey.
Movers and shakers, that's what I'm saying. And the balloon definitely moved and shook. It is a close one, to be fair. Yeah. In hindsight, should we have picked Andy Burnham?
No.
Is that just on principle?
One, that just never choose Andy Burnham on principle. And two, to be quite honest, he's not actually having that much of a good time up in the North either.
He was the North, Steve. No, doesn't he embody northernness and all its northern form?
He'd like to think so.
He's from the North. Did he not tell you that?
But Burnham has been having a bit of a hard time up in Greater Manchester with a few bits and pieces. Whilst they've acquired some extra powers, like going after health, being devolved down. There's been some issues around... there's been a lot of issues around transport up north. Thank you, Chris Grayling. But in particular, there's been some projects which Burnham and his team have been trying to get set up, which have been not very well handled very well. And as a result of that, he's probably doing about as well as the other two.
Okay.
So basically, busted flush all around, I'd say, for mayors.
Yes, it's almost like they need some decent powers, isn't it?
Yeah, odd that.
Yeah. Right. Okay, the final one. In many ways, the last but not least.
Oh, boy.
In terms of influential commentator, I picked Nick Timothy. You picked Owen Jones. How do you feel, Steve, about Owen Jones at the moment?
How do I feel about Squealer? He's become an absolute parody of himself. This is a man who was once, a meaningful journalist. Like, the work he did with The Establishment, the work he did with Chavs, you know, you can disagree with him, whatever. Those were good pieces of actual journalism and kind of like, writing. He was and is actually quite good at what he's meant to be doing. But the problem is he's ceased to be a journalist and has become an activist. He has become beholden solely to the cause of trying to get a left Labour government elected in some form, to the extent where he's abandoned, I would say, any actual principles he once had in terms of his journalistic integrity. He's just on a WhatsApp list and he's just playing out whatever the Seamus Milne is telling him to. Mm. I've got no respect for him anymore. And the fact that I went from, at the beginning of the year, thinking, oh, this is a man who could be very influential in British politics, to this man is a waste of time and I've ceased to read anything he ever puts out.
I think he's still very influential in the circle of left-wing Labour activists. The impression I get, though, is that Owen Jones had a little bit of, during the dying dog days, probably about February 2017, when Labour was 87 points behind in the polls, he did actually write some nice, quiet, good analytical articles about where Corbyn's Labour was going wrong and what he might be able to and what needed to be done. But since the election, Jones has gone full swing behind whatever the leader's office needs him to say.
Yeah,
and I think that's really sad.
Yeah, I mean, he started flirting with trying to make Clive Lewis leader. He moved away from the Corbyn project a little bit when he thought that it wasn't going to be electorally viable, which, to be quite honest, he wasn't alone in that. But then since the election, he's been trying to get back into the leadership's good books, and he's just gone too far the other way at the expense of his credibility as a journalist.
Speaking of people going too far at the expense of their credibility, let's talk about Nick Timothy.
Oh, that was a good segue.
Wasn't it? That was the king of segues. Now, Nick Timothy, you may remember, now writes a column for The Sun and The Telegraph, advising, basically saying what he thinks the Prime Minister should do every week. Of course, his qualification for getting this job was he actually used to tell the Prime Minister what to do every week.
And then lost her an election.
Again, this seemed like a good pick of mine at the start of the year because he'd written in the Sun column about how Justine Greening should be moved from education because she doesn't like grammar schools. And no, I can't believe, apparently, not liking grammar schools is a disqualification for being Education Secretary, but there we are. Justine Greening was moved and ended up resigning from the Cabinet as a result. So it looked like he was still quite influential. Since then, we had an article for the Telegraph about George Soros and his influence on British politics, which had a lot of anti-Semitic tropes in it. Also, then he had to quit Twitter because... Well, he quit Twitter of his own volition because he, I think, tried to say that Theresa May wasn't behind the migration vans about go home because she was on holiday or something.
And yet she was. There were signatures and everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's fair to say that 2018 is not a year in which Nick Timothy or Owen Jones have necessarily covered themselves in glory.
No, but in terms of which one of them has had... Now, see, this is interesting because, like, in terms of how, which one of them's probably had a better 2018, I'd say it's probably Timothy just because he seems to have stopped digging. Whilst Owen has still got the shovel firmly in hand and is seems hell-bent on getting himself down to China.
I mean, if in terms of... It depends. Nick Timothy's probably had more influence on UK government policy.
And I feel like, again, looking back at this period, historians are going to look at these two individuals and they'll probably spend a lot more time talking about Owen Jones than they will Nick Timothy. Because Owen Jones, as you say, has just fallen into ridiculousness, I'd say.
Go to our website, notenoughchampagne.com, or go to our Twitter page, at nochampagnepod, or follow me on Twitter, at Paperback Writer.
And I'm at Acoustic Radical.
James Crown designed our logo, and Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Good Goody Plug Times. For our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. We didn't actually, at the end of that, about who won. I think probably edges maybe me on points. I think I've got more of the clearer wins, but you've probably got more wins overall, so it probably depends how you're going to do it. But
I'd say that works out of a draw.
It probably works out of the draw, doesn't it? So stay tuned for December. Who knows what's going to happen? Listen to our episode in January. Maybe one of us will pick Gavin Williamson. Happy plotting, everyone.